And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy!
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds!
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
The Athletic.
Mercedes takes historic 1-2-3-4. There's argy-bargy as the rest fight over the scraps. The driver merry-go-round goes into overdrive, and an old friend returns in the latest instalment of Sam's Calendar Update. I'm Andrew Vandenberg, and this is the Race Formula E podcast, Berlin E-Prix Edition. Hello everyone, and welcome to another action-packed show. After two more races around the Tempelhof Airport, we've got loads to talk about, and joining me to do just that is, as ever, the Race Formula E Meister, Sam Smith, and our special guest, Alice Powell. As well as being a leading light of W Series, Alice is the simulator and development driver for Envision Racing. Alice, you've written columns for the race, you've been on a video for WTF1 teaching Katie Fairman how to kart. Now you're completing the Holy Trinity by making your podcasting debut. Thank you for coming on the show.
No worries, thanks for having me, guys.
Right, we've got a lot to get through, so let's start with the races. Sam, two races, two wins for Mercedes powertrains. What was it about Tempelhof that led to this domination?
Well, I think it's really easy to just say that it's because the track is more suited to the Mercedes powertrain and the way it treats its tyres, particularly on this super quirky runway asphalt that we have there. But actually, that's only part of it. You know, yes, ultimately they have all those things, but the hard work that goes on at both Mercedes EQ and the Rocket Venturi teams combined with how the driver applies it and their style really just came to the fore over the weekend. Remember that the temperatures were much reduced from the August hothouse last season. So it was a very different type of parameters that the teams were racing to, I think, this weekend, last weekend. You know, what we definitely saw with Eduardo Mortara was that he was able to turn in and just rotate his car at the hairpins much more efficiently than the others. I mean, that was clearly evident on the onboard camera. And it was sublime. I mean, when you watched it, it looked like he was driving a different series to the rest of his competitors. One team boss described it to me as if he had power steering. It was just so precise as he went through many of those pretty tight turns at Tempelhof. So, you know, he had the advantage. And in particular, it was because he's got great application in the powertrain, and then that brings great efficiency. But where he really benefited was just on the simple vehicle dynamics of how he used his tyres and how he managed to save or at least preserve his rear tyres and thus cut out any extreme oversteer, which a lot of the others were unable to do effectively. So, you know, I think he just had a combination of factors that suited his style. And as we saw, it reaps some great results.
Alice, we ran two versions of the track, the traditional, or what's become the traditional version on the Saturday and the reversed layout on the Sunday. In terms of the demands and setup on the car, how much do they differ?
Not too much, to be honest. I mean, as Sam touched on, the asphalt or the tarmac, it's not even tarmac, is it? It's quite strange. So either way you go around the track, you're going to experience the same sort of degradation and the way that the tyres come in. So there isn't too much difference. And I've raced there in the Jaguar I-Pace E-Trophy when that was a support race back a couple of years ago to the Formula E. And we didn't change too much on the car either. We just obviously adjusted tyre pressures for the direction that you went of the circuit. So, you know, it's definitely a challenging weekend. They're full on weekends, Formula E weekends, but also for the drivers to then sort of switch and turn their brains the other way around as such to adjust to the track being the other direction. But, you know, it's always one for me. And when I experienced it back in the I-Pace, I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed the challenge of going the other way. So, you know, as again Sam said, that it really definitely suited this sort of circuit, the Mercedes powertrains, whereas others were sort of struggling with some overheating of tyres. And that was certainly, I think, was one of the things that we Envision sort of struggled a little bit with at the weekend as well.
Yeah, we'll get into Envision's performance a little bit later. But Sam, you mentioned Mortara and his performance in that first race and some quite canny strategy from Venturi and how he was deploying the attack mode there. But behind him, there was just this almighty battle that was almost the entire top 10 swapping positions almost every lap. I mean, it was a great call from Venturi to come out on top of that.
Yeah, I mean, canny is the operative word there. They were super cute on how they executed that strategy on, particularly on Saturday. I think, you know, seeing how it was applied, I think Edo needs a lot of credit because I think his style suited how he could actually manage the pace from the front, which isn't an easy thing to do in 2022 Formula E racing because you've got the slipstream effect. We saw that at Monaco and we saw that Mitch Evans really suffered from that, but Edo didn't. He managed it pretty conservatively, but when he needed to step it up, he did, and he hit his energy targets and he hit his minimum speed requirements. I think a lot of credit as well has to go to the chief engineer, Jeremy Collinson, and the head of performance, Alex Dardelet, who's Edo's engineer as well. You know, they read the race super well, and leaving that attack mode slightly later, even though he lost places to Lotter and Van Dorn, he was able to come through pretty quickly and pick them off. He also had to resist Jean-Éric Vergne's slightly do-or-die attack in the, I think, the penultimate lap when he tried to move and Edo let him go and then he just jinked by on the inside. And from there, it was not an easy run to the flag, but he had it fully under control. You always felt he had a little bit in reserve if he needed it. And, you know, the big story for Edo was that he actually, you know, he managed to get that monkey off his back, didn't he, of a pole position, and he had doubled it up. You know, it's the old adage, isn't it? You know, two buses come at once. So he just did a great job. And I think now we always knew he'd be in the mix in the championship, but I think after the slight trough of Rome and of Monaco, when he retired from races because of contacts, not his fault generally, the momentum's back with him, and he's a genuine threat with that package that he has.
Alice, in contrast to the sort of cut and thrust of the first race, the second one was, well, relatively processional, with Nyck de Vries really winning at a canter. Why do you think that was?
I think teams had sort of redefined, or sort of not redefined, that's the wrong word, but, you know, tweaked their setup a little bit more over what they learned in the first race. Obviously, with Formula E, you have the shakedown, but, you know, you're restricted to what power mode you use there. And then when the free practice sessions, they're not particularly long. So it's quite, that it's not, you don't get a great deal of running in Formula E. So they don't have a huge amount of time to really get the setups dialed in. You know, again, Sam mentioned that the track temperatures were a lot different from last year, August last year. It was super hot. So, you know, the teams would have learned a lot in race one. And I think that probably played into, you know, teams finding a little bit here and there. It's maybe some not as much as others. And then that affected the result and how close the field was in the second race.
Sam, in contrast to Mortara's win at the front, teammate Lucas Degrassi was quite a way down the order in that first race. What happened to him?
Yeah, he had a bad day on Saturday. Didn't get his second quali lap together at all, and it anchored him down to 13th. He actually got a really decent start in the race, but then had some, I believe he had some contact early on and developed a slow puncture, which he had to pit, and then, you know, was way back hoping for a safety car, but it never came, and they actually parked the car a couple of laps from the flag to save aspects of it. So, yeah, disappointing day for him, and obviously, you know, all the more galling to see his teammate take a victory. But I think you know, that interesting dynamic between Degrassi and Mortara is still there. I spoke to Jerome D'Ambrosio at length, actually over breakfast on the Thursday at Berlin. And the way that it was handled, I think, after Monaco, when they collided and ruined Edo's race, was pretty impressive, actually. You know, Jerome is a new team principal, don't forget. You know, he only started in the role at the beginning of this season, but he's kind of made a really good niche for himself. And I think that was handled internally, as these things should be. And it's, you know, there is that combustibility, isn't there, with drivers and with two strong characters like Mortara and Degrassi. I think, as we alluded to in the last podcast, it was always going to happen, but they seem to have sort of quelled that a little bit. And you know, Lucas still has to, you know, he has to try and get on terms with Edo. And after last weekend, he's, you know, he's got an even bigger task, I feel.
Talking of combustibility, Alice, we had some genuine controversy in qualifying when Alexander Sims and Jean-Éric Vergne set exactly the same time in the head-to-head stage in qualifying, only for Sims to progress because he set the time first. And what did you make of all of the fallout from that?
Well, I was watching that at the time and I couldn't believe it. I thought, what are the odds? That just shows of how close Formula E is, how competitive the championship is. And to be honest with you, you know, Caroon said it in commentary, and I actually agree with him that they probably should have done it again, because obviously you don't have control over who goes out the pit lane first. So Alexander, he went out the pit lane first, and then Jean-Éric Vergne went out second. So that was the order that they had to go in. There was no choice. They weren't allowed to race to the pit lane to queue up to try and decide who goes first. So I think, you know, that was out of Jean-Éric Vergne's control and Alexander's control. Luckily, he set the lap time first. But I think, you know, to keep it fair, and I know there's probably maybe a bit of a time restriction with TV and stuff, but I would have liked to have seen, if it was from my point of view, especially being if I was in Jean-Éric Vergne's shoes, to have that lap or that shootout sort of ran aground. Maybe they come in the pits, they sit, and the next lot go out, and then they run it again. But I think to keep it fair, they should have probably altered the rules there and have sent Jean-Éric Vergne out again. So I'd like to see if they maybe have a look back on that and decide to alter that slightly.
You can see why the rule is what it is, because if we remember back to Jerez 97, when those top three all set the same time, it was done in the order they went out. But that's a very different format to this head-to-head thing where, you know, it's supposed to be, you know, this ultimate competition thing. We're going to have a rules amendment here, aren't we, as a result of this?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, if there wasn't the rule where, you know, they have to go out in a specific order, then I think fair enough. You know, if you wait 10 seconds compared to your competitor and go out 10 seconds later and you set the same time but you didn't do it first, then fair enough. But because, you know, they have no control over the order that they go out of the pit lane at this stage of qualifying, I think it's then only fair to, you know, change that rule so that the lap is, they then redo the lap or redo the shootout, you know, to give, you know, a fair sort of comparison. And, you know, then we sort of decide fairly, really, of who should progress through to the next part of qualifying.
I mean, given it's based on a football knockout system, maybe the teams could arrange a little five-a-side penalty shootout or something at the end and decide it that way.
Yeah, maybe. Let's say for the British drivers, I don't know if we'd do it quite as well, but yeah, who knows?
Sam, Jev was understandably upset by this, but he channeled it all to be that battle in second place that you mentioned. Yeah, on Sunday, he was a distant ninth. Why were the contrast?
Yeah, you're right. He was good on Saturday, drove a good race, but actually at the same time, I think he had a really good chance to win it. And I think he knew that. I spoke to him after the race. He decided to, in his own words, not trust his team with telling him when to take his attack mode. And he took it a lap later than was intended, which was his decision, which I'm not sure was completely aligned to what the team were looking for him to do. Clearly wasn't. And, you know, whether that changed anything for him is up for debate. But certainly he spent a bit of time. There was some orchestration with his teammate Antonio Felix da Costa, which I think maybe cost him a little bit more, which he was a bit rattled by. You know, how many times have we heard that before with the Esteghlal? And it's an intricate thing to try and plot out during a race, that's for sure. But, you know, I think he sort of rued the fact that he wasn't able to, I suppose, just end that drought. You know, he's not won since Rome last season, which is
amazing.
You know, it's a big drought for Jean-Éric Vergne. He's used to winning, and you could see that in the slight disappointment afterwards. And I think on Sunday he just generally lacked grip. I mean, he didn't do an especially great qualifying lap. Rarely does Vergne not get into to the group stages into the duels, but he didn't on Sunday. Lacked grip, struggled with the tyres. Things improved in the second half of the race and his pace picked up. But I think, again, just a legacy of the variation in the sets that the Michelins they had. So he fell away and, he did get a clutch of points, but lost a little bit of momentum because he'd been so consistent up until that point this season.
Alice, Envision had their worst qualifying of the year on Saturday with Robin Freins and Nick Cassidy on the penultimate row. Yeah, on Sunday, Robin was on the front row. So how did they manage that turnaround?
Yeah, I mean, obviously quite a contrast of days from the first race on Saturday to the second race on the Sunday. You know, Robin was really disappointed with the first day. He in all honesty as well got held up. He felt so probably would have progressed, but then obviously, you know, starting for at the back of the formerly pack, it's never going to be easy in any race car to try and move your way through, especially when you're conserving energy. But the team did a great job, turned it round. You know, Nick did a fantastic job as well. To have both cars go through into the shootouts was great. And, you know, Nick's just unfortunate that he had to take the penalty for changing bits on the car. But yeah, Robin had a strong race. And I think, as we've seen, you need to really try and be consistent in Formula E. And okay, we didn't have the best day on the Saturday, but the team bounced back and we had, you know, especially for Robin's side, another consistent result. Thereabouts in the top five, and I think that's going to be key, trying to rack up these results and finishing in the top five to end, you know, towards the end of the season be in the right position in the points.
On the last lap of that race on Sunday, we saw that coming together between Robin and Antonio Felix da Costa, which cost da Costa that place. Why did it go unpunished?
That's a good question, and I mean, you know, when I watched it on the TV, I thought, oh, I had to sort of see it again because I wasn't sure if Antonio had changed line at all. And obviously he hadn't. I think it was Robin obviously didn't mean to do it. He apologised to Antonio. Basically, Robin moved, you know, from Robin's point of view, he moved left just as Antonio was lifting. So maybe the officials saw that, you know, it's hard to tell when the driver in front is going to lift. You have no idea. You're obviously on different, the last lap, different energy sort of settings. Robin had slightly bit more energy than Antonio, so obviously was able to lift slightly later because he didn't need to save as much energy on that last lap. So the only thing I could think is maybe the officials thought, well, you know, it's the last lap. It's mixed energy levels. It was just one of those racing incidents that he didn't mean to do. It just happened to be that Antonio lifted at the point where Robin was going left. If he didn't lift to save energy at that point, there wouldn't have been any contact. So the only thing is maybe I can see is they took that from you know, the point of view that it was just unfortunate that he happened to lift at the time that Robin was moving left. Robin had no idea that he was going to lift at all.
I think Alice is dead right. You know, there was certainly no malice in this. You know, it was a combination of factors that just happened to coincide and cause this incident. I think really what you've got to ask the stewards, or maybe, you know, they could somehow communicate the rationale for coming to these decisions, because yeah, I didn't speak to one person in the paddock on Sunday night who agreed with there not being any penalty for Robin. And even Robin was surprised. You know, he said he had some good fortune from the stewarding office after the race. For me, and my opinion, and I'm not privy to all the data that the stewards got, obviously, it looks from every angle, this would be a slam dunk penalty of some description. It was very clear that da Costa was lifting and coasting, which is an inherent part of Formula E, especially at that point in the race. And he just defended as Robin attacked, ultimately, and they had the collision. So, you know, listen, as I said, there's no malice at all in this. It's just an unfortunate combination. I don't drive these things, but I know a lot of people who do, and no one really understood why somebody who contacted the back of another car and gained a position because of it did not have a sanction for that. You know, does as Da Costa told us on Sunday, does this set a precedent for future races? I'm not sure. That might be a bit strong. I mean, maybe it will. I don't know. But if it does to any extent, then it's dangerous, because as we saw in Mexico City in 2019, when Nelson Piquet vaulted over the back of Jean-Éric Vergne, it can lead to a big shunt, these type of incidents. And the drivers know what they're doing. You know, they've got a lot of experience and they know how to race. Sometimes an unfortunate circumstance like this occurs. So I think from the steward's point of view, there's a perceived lack of consistency. And I'm going to sort of deep dive a little bit here, but I'll keep it as brief as I can. There were two other incidents during the qualifying on Sunday which kind of went unnoticed. Nyck de Vries failed to stop at the weighbridge because he said he thought the signal to stop was there for his teammate, Stoffel Vandoorne. This incident was deemed, it was investigated, no further action was taken. Now, I can't remember when somebody failed to stop for a weighbridge that it didn't go unpunished, but it did on Sunday. The big reveal here is that Vandoorne was in the other group. So how does that stack up? The fact that the bulletin states that weighbridge procedure was conflicting and unclear, isn't a good look for a world championship, is it? So there's a lot of question marks over that one. A few moments later, Nick Cassidy, he was weighed, completed his weighing procedure, but under what he said was a marshal signal, drove back to his pit down the wrong way of the pit lane. After a hearing, he was given a 5-place grid drop for two penalty points. That could look like a real lack of consistency, couldn't it, for whatever happened there? So there was this little bit of chaos in the pits. Both offences saw the toss argued, and one was let go because of the hearing, and then the other gets penalised pretty severely for Nick Cassidy. I'm not saying that these incidents should be tied together, because they were clearly separate offences and should be adjudged so. But where is the consistency and where is the treatment of these with similar sanctions, which you thought would have come for incidents that were inherently different, but in the context appear to have some similarities as well? So yeah, I think this is a story that will probably run into the next race at Jakarta, and I know that a lot of the teams are questioning some of the application of these decisions.
So I'm looking at the Jaguar performance over the weekend, in the mix on the first race, again one of the ones that fell backwards on the Sunday, but overall, you know, still very much in the hunt and nothing really to be concerned about.
No, I don't think there's cause for concern. I mean, not unless we end up with six more races at Tempelhof. I think Jaguar was just one of those teams that's really struggled to get their tyres into a window. I mean, it was so difficult to do, but to actually apply their vehicle dynamics effectively over the duration of a race. I mean, Mitch had a strong race on Saturday. He went from 10th to 5th, but on Sunday just couldn't get the tyres into these really narrow windows, and what that does is it chews up the rears. You get a horrible amount of oversteer, and you just go backwards from there relative to the tight competition in Formula E this year. We're talking tenths of a second, if not hundredths and thousandths. It's really that close. So really frustrating for Jaguar, but at least Mitch got a point. That might be super important at the end of the season. But I think, you know, one point from a race for a title challenging team like Jaguar TCS Racing was you know, it was a big disappointment for them. They just looked a bit blunt on Sunday, but equally, as we've seen before this season, from the first three races for Mitch in particular to Rome, where he dominated, they are a force and they can bite back pretty severely. So I expect them to, and I think it's just a combination of the track and really struggling with the tyres was what hit them last weekend.
Alice, it was another tough weekend for Sam Bird, who's just really not been able to get on Mitch Evans's pace so far this season. He's the only driver to have won in every season. I think we would all back him to turn it around, but he's running out of races now.
Yeah, as you said, I think don't write him off. We know it's Sam Bird and how quick he can be, and he's won races in every season, and that just says it. That stat there just says everything about him. You know, he's always pushing 100%. He's a top driver, obviously. I had the pleasure of working with him for a little bit while he was here Envision. So, you know, a great guy. And yeah, I would certainly bet on him winning a race this season and turning it around. He's certainly not going to give up. And Jaguar, I know, will push extremely hard to make sure that they give Sam the best car that they can.
Sam, across practice, it looked like this was possibly going to be a Porsche track, and they were, you know, both drivers were looking strong and potentially in the hunt for race wins, yet they really didn't deliver in terms of results. Are they starting to under-deliver again this season?
Well, they did a bit in Berlin. I think that was plain. It seemed like they sort of reverted to the old Porsche of looking really potent and then just not executing the race as you thought they would. And it is a track that they know more than any other since they came into Formula E back in 2019. That momentum from Mexico has flatlined a little bit now. You know, they were really unfortunate in Monaco with that reliability issue, which was actually the 12-volt battery, the ancillary battery, not the main battery, which caused that retirement for Pascal Wehrlein. Florian Modlinger told us that just ahead of of heading to Berlin. But I think looking at it more positively, obviously the deal with Andretti was announced, that they'll be supplying Andretti for 2023, as well as their main factory operation. You know, this will I think add some impetus for Generation 3. But the fact is they're still fading in the point standings a little bit now from the Mercedes teams and Jaguar and Envision 2 and DS to Cheetah. I think in terms of, they could be the manufacturer that actually shifts some focus to 2023. Now, I'm not saying they will write off 2022 to any extent at all, because they clearly have the car and they have the drivers to win more races this season. And it could well be that they put a string of results in and one of their drivers is able to challenge for the title. That's entirely possible. But I just feel that if ever there was a manufacturer that was looking at the bigger picture and how important 2023 for them is, for lots of reasons, they could make that call. But equally, they have all the capabilities and they have the resources to do both extremely well. So, yeah, a little bit of a blow because it was on home turf as well for Porsche. But I expect them to be pretty strong when everyone heads to a new track, which is Jakarta in a couple of weeks' time.
Well, that's it for part one and a look back at Tempelhof. Coming up in part two, we'll go through all the various news that came out of the weekend.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep. You heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Well, Alex, you can sit back and have a cuppa now for the next few minutes as it's the inevitable return of Sam's calendar update. Berlin has extended its deal for a couple more years, which is great news for the only event to have taken place every season. While there's a familiar track returning to plug the Vancouver hole, Sam.
Yes, we're going back to Marrakesh, which has hosted several E-Prix over the years. It's an interesting venue. It will be certainly in July because we've never been in the middle of the summer, so the temperatures are going to be the key factor there. I think the average temperature is around 94, 95 degrees. So it is going to be very testing for everything that the teams apply with these races, especially the thermal temperature of the batteries. I think the hottest race certainly was the Santiago 2019 event, which you were at, VDB, because I remember both of us basically being puddles at the side of the track during the free practice session, which was held in the morning, and then it got hotter in the afternoon and the track crumbled. The track was like cottage cheese, wasn't it, by the end of it? So I don't think it's going to be that severe, but it certainly will be fairly toasty out there. I think it was a popular replacement, a super sub race, and I think the main thing is that you know, we don't have another one of these big gaps. No one wants that, so we will have 16 races at 10 events as planned. They did look at Jakarta to hold a double, but it was felt that with the new infrastructure and the personnel in Indonesia and the marshals in particular, that I don't think anyone really wanted to overface something so new there. So we will have 16. Berlin, yes, an extension of the Tempelhof. The mayor of Berlin was there on Sunday, and that deal is done. It's a race that, when you look at it, a disused airport with a vast expanse of tarmac and grass probably shouldn't work, but it does. I really love going there, and I really love Berlin. It takes my breath away.
Yeah, it's really made its name as a Formula E venue now, hasn't it? It's established.
It is. You know, we had that one-off, didn't we, at Alexanderplatz that didn't work because there was so much... it wasn't great, and there was so much disruption to the city centre. But it works at Tempelhof, and we get some great racing. And actually, it was really nice to see at the weekend. It was the first one where there were no restrictions. So we had there was a really great e-village, and there was an atmosphere, and the grandstands were full, which is great to see again. And long may that continue.
The other big news pre-race was the final confirmation of McLaren taking over the Mercedes thing that you've been teasing us with for months on end, Sam. It's going to have some backing from Saudi Arabia, but how is this deal actually going to work?
Well, it's actually very simple. McLaren will take over the existing Mercedes EQ team. Mercedes are leaving, as we've known since last August, which we've talked about and tried to rationalise, and we haven't. Everyone's still baffled by it, but it's done. It's history. But the hope is that they will come back in the future at some stage. So McLaren will take over. They will own it. They will have the licence. It will be financed through what we believe to be a significant investment from Saudi Arabia. So we expect to see some of the names that are already on the silver cars to transfer to what could be orange. We don't know yet how that's going to be. Ian James will continue to be the team principal, and the vast majority of the team will be retained and essentially plugged in and played again for next year when it will become McLaren. It won't be based in Brackley, and it won't be based in Woking, I'm told. There will be a facility close to Brackley where this will be run from, and there will be elements that are used and deployed via Woking as well as the core engineering team that is there at the moment. You know, we covered this story, as you said, pretty closely since the start of the year, and it's nice to see it all come off and become public. Zach Brown hosted a media roundtable remotely on Saturday morning when this was announced, and I think there's general positivity. It's a great news story for the championship. It ensures there will be 11 teams on the grid next year. We know about the re-entry of AT. There's a bigger question mark over to Cheetah, but you'll be able to read a lot more about that on the -race.com. Should know that by now.
Got there in the end.
Nissan powertrains are going to be used. That's not been officially confirmed, but I think it will be soon. And the driver lineup we're going to come on to, but I think they're going to have a pretty stellar couple of peddlers in that team for next season.
Alice, pre-weekend, Sam did a story about Formula E chairman Alejandro Agag wanting to forge a closer relationship with Formula One. You currently race the W Series, which is part of the support bill for some of the Grand Prix. How do you imagine a Formula E F1 tie-up would work?
I think having more teams that race in Formula One have a tie-up with a team in Formula E. So, for example, like McLaren coming along to join Formula E, obviously with the hybrid era in Formula One, I think the teams could certainly learn a lot from about the batteries, etc., and information that they get from Formula E. They could probably transfer that across into their Formula One team. So I think that will be a great link up with having some more F1 teams move into Formula E. So I think it's great to see McLaren coming in. Obviously more great competition on the grid for the other teams as well. But also on other stuff within the paddocks. Obviously those of people that will know that when they've been in a Formula E paddock, you know, there's plenty of places to recycle, water stations, you know, that are giving out refillable sort of bottles. And I think Formula One could certainly have a good use of combining that with Formula E and developing some sort of system for the fans that they can recycle more and encourage people to travel to the venues in a more eco-friendly way. And I think if the two championships come together, I'm sure they could draw something up and, you know, also increase fans across both sides of the board to help our planet. So I think from a fan point of view, it'd be great, and it'd be great for Formula E as well, and also Formula One. So I think the starting point would be is getting more Formula One teams to invest in Formula E and enter a team into the championship.
Yeah, I think that's there's some really sensible ideas there. Sam, you mentioned Andretti confirming its Porsche powertrain supply. What impact is that going to have on their driver lineup? But also, I think I've never seen so many potential or confirmed driver moves around the Formula E entry. So why don't we go team by team and who's going to be where for next season? We can start with the newest team to return to Formula E, so apt.
Before we do that, I've never known such a feverish a couple of days in the driver market. There was rumour, counter-rumour. There were driver managers running around, you know, with beads of sweat on their foreheads. It was all very entertaining to watch and to sort of understand what might be going on. Obviously, no one really knows until the ink is applied to the contracts. But, yeah, Thomas Biermeier and members of his team were in Berlin for a couple of days and looking and speaking to people and understanding how, after a year away, to get that team formed. I think it's highly likely that we'll see Robin Freins and Nico Müller in those cars. The contracts aren't formed and signed, but their strong preference, I think, is to have those two guys that they've known for a long time and have been part of their DTM packages and other things. And it makes a whole lot of sense to have Robin and Nico for the start of Gen 3, I think. Andretti, you mentioned, obviously, Porsche power for next season. I think that Jake Dennis has a deal for next season, but the details of any performance clauses or extrication possibilities are obviously not known by anyone outside of that tight unit there. Word in the paddock is that Jake is keeping his options open and talking to other teams, which obviously most drivers do. Interestingly and intriguingly, he's part of the ADD management stable that looks after Lando Norris and has a certain Mr. Zach Brown as part of its makeup. So make of that what you will, but at the moment it seems reasonably open at Andretti. Dragon, as we know, Dragon will become DS Dragon or DS Penske or however they, whatever it, the naming of that operation will become for next season. And we believe that Jean-Éric Vergne and Stoffel Van Dorn are deals that are done there. Alice, Envision, we're not going to embarrass you by talking about Envision's plans for next season, but...
Oh, come on, reveal exactly what's going on. We need the full insight here.
I have no idea, so I couldn't even help you if you wanted me to.
No, I think Nick Cassidy is going to be staying with the team for next season. Obviously, there looks like there is a Robin Freins-shaped hole in that team, and Yeah, we've written.
Come on, it's a cheeky rumor. Come on, get a cheeky rumor out there. This is all rumor mongering. This bit.
Well, I wrote a piece last week before Berlin that the team is the team's talking to Sebastian Buemi amongst other drivers, and I think someone of Sebastian's experience and technical know-how and understanding what Formula E is all about, even though he's had a very difficult couple of years, would be a very smart move for that team, and a Cassidy and Buemi. Duo at that team would be fairly strong, but we'll have to wait and see what develops there. Jaguar has been done for several months. Mitch Evans and Sam Bird confirmed. Mahindra, I think Oliver Rowland is going to stay there. I think he's got a deal for next season. There's been a long held rumor that Lucas Degrassi will move to Mahindra next season. That is yet to be confirmed, and whether that actually happens, we'll have to wait and see. I think he could end up at Mahindra. Maserati, which is the Venturi team, which will become Maserati next season. I think I don't see any reason why Edo Mortara would leave there or want to leave there. They will obviously be running essentially DS packages for next year. His teammate is one of the big questions. I think there's lots of drivers in discussions there, and it's an attractive seat. Ultimately, Lucas Degrassi could easily make it an unchanged lineup there, but I think that's looking less likely, and that it's really open. I wouldn't like to mention anyone there. I think Giovinazzi has been mentioned purely because of his nationality, and he's driven for Stellantis brands before, etc., but certainly nothing appears to be done at the moment. McLaren, we ran a story about René Rast possibly returning to Formula E, and he is talking to the team closely about terms. It's unsure whether anything's actually agreed or signed, but it looks like René Rast could be a really good option for McLaren. The second seat appears to be completely open. I don't think Nyck de Vries is going to be there. I think he's going to have other things to do, whether it's in Formula E or WEC, potentially with Toyota, and whether or not he can combine the two and do a dual program. Neo 333, I don't think anything is signed. It's completely open there. Obviously, they have two strong drivers in Dan Ticktum and Oliver Turvey at the moment. Whether or not they, either one of those or both, could be continued, we'll have to wait and see. But certainly other drivers are talking to Neo. Nissan appears to be pretty open at the minute. I think they're chasing a big name in the championship. So my advice for that would be to log on to the-race.com in the coming weeks to see the latest on that one. Porsche, Pascal Wehrlein will drive them next season. And as we've written a month or so ago now, Antonio Felix da Costa will join him at that team, and that will be announced later in the summer. Tichita, as we touched on, are struggling to continue. They're looking for an investor and a buyer, and they also will be looking for two drivers, a powertrain and a headquarters. So lots of work to do at Tichita, that's for sure. And I think that covers it, VDB. I think we're across the grid there.
Yeah, it's well done, you know. Given how stable, certainly at the front end of the grid, given how stable the lineups were for the first sort of iteration of Formula E, it's amazing the amount that are going on there. And as you rightly said, check out the-race.com for all your latest news. Now, of course, we look forward to the next new track to come onto the Formula E calendar, and that's in the Indonesian capital of Jakarta. Alice, have you driven it in the sim yet?
I haven't. I'm actually here at the sim today, so I'm guessing that's going to be on my agenda. So I can't give any info really into the track as yet, which would be, maybe I should have done that first thing this morning before recording this, but I think a lot of the team are excited. I know Robin and the drivers are excited for going there, so hopefully it will be a strong one for us.
What from looking at the sort of circuit map, what are you expecting when you finally do get behind the wheel in the sim?
I think it's going to be quite a tricky circuit, to be honest. I think the teams will obviously be working hard on their sim models. We certainly will be working hard because, as I've mentioned earlier, we don't get a lot of running in Formula E. It's quite limited. So there's a lot of information for not just the drivers to take in, but the teams to take in as well in terms of learning the circuit and, you know, the way the asphalt is, certain corners, the temperatures. They're expecting it to be quite a warm one as well. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays into different teams' hands. So I think it'll be tricky. And a new circuit in Formula E is always tricky. And for that obvious reason that no one's ever been there before, we don't get much running.
Yes, it's going to be... they're always interesting, new tracks. There's always inevitably the odd installation problem as drain covers need welding down or curbs are in slightly the wrong places or whatever. Sam, it's definitely going to be hot. Having been to Malaysia and Singapore, possibly a chance of heavy overnight rain to wash the track off again. What are you expecting to happen?
It's a completely open one. I mean, I spoke to Scott Elkins, the race director, who's done a site visit there relatively recently, and he said that the track looks fantastic. I think it's quite close to the coast. It's got a slight feeling of Sanya, which was a couple of years ago, a little island in Hainan off the south of China. That sort of feel. It's a man-made street track, let's say, but challenging. I think Scott said it was, from the material we've seen, the films we've seen, he says that it, you know, it actually looks more impressive and bigger from actually being at the circuit. So it'll be a challenge. The weather is always a factor there. You know, when it comes down, it really comes down there. It will be hot. It'll be sticky. It'll be challenging, and it'll be really interesting to see what happens. I think there's I think the fact that it's not a double header, I think ultimately is good, because there'll be so many fresh curveballs to throw at teams. I think, you know, going to a new circuit and having a double header is a big ask for everybody. And ultimately, I think it for the championship, I'd much rather see double header events at established tracks, which we're going to see at New York and now the Excel. But then, you know, I'm going to contradict myself right here and now, because the season's going to finish in Seoul, which is a brand new track. And I got an exclusive interview with Mr. Moon, who is the promoter of the Seoul E-Prix, and you can read that on the Hyphen Race.
Is he over the moon about his prospects for that race?
I think it's not going to be the first time we use those kind of analogies, right? I think he's a very interesting character, and was very positive about everything about that race. And you'll be able to read it on the site soon about the plans that they've got there. It looks absolutely fantastic. It's going to race inside and then come out to the perimeter roads of the Seoul Olympic Stadium, the 1988 Olympic Stadium, to which I said, well, does that mean we've all got to dress in shell suits and rock the 1988 fashion look during the weekend? So I think I'm going to have to do that at some stage.
Pump ourselves full of as many steroids as we can get our hands on.
I'm not going there on that one. I'm not going to the Ben Johnson route. Absolutely not.
No, please don't. Well, I think that's a good place to wrap the show for today. A huge thank you to Alice for joining us, and we wish you all the very best of luck for the remainder of W Series.
Thank you very much.
And don't forget to check out the other podcasts from the race, including a bumper series that we've got coming from the Indy 500 later this month. Goodbye.
Athletic.